When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit. Hello and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast all about leaving the EU. Today we're going to be talking about chlorinated chicken, among other things, but before we do any of that, thank you for getting in touch with us on Twitter, and also thank you for leaving us those iTunes reviews. We really do appreciate them, and it just helps spread the word to other people about the stuff that we're doing over here. Talking of over here, I am in Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce, and as always, I am joined by Christian Spence. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
And Alex Davis.
Hiya.
Now, let's kick off with a bit of a continuation from last week, because we did speak about the negative tone and the, how can we say, the unencouraging signs from the UK team. But things seem to have taken a little bit of a different turn this week.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I think actually, if anything, I need to apologise as well. I mean, last week's podcast became pretty miserable. As we started tearing our hair out, I think all of the tension that particularly Alex and I have had over the government just came flooding out last week. So we're going to go for a bit more of an optimistic line this week. But yeah, I'll let Alex kick this off. But we've seen some positive news from government.
Yeah, there's been a bit of a shift in tone, it seems, and it kind of feels like it happened overnight, maybe on Wednesday last week or something like that. Because obviously last week we had the second official round of negotiations with David Davis flying over to Brussels and then leaving after an hour or something like that. Apparently that was all planned, and that Barnier also left. But then they went back and kind of concluded them. And, you know, our side kind of again reported it kind of felt like again they were denying reality somewhat, saying that there's been lots of progress, and you know, we know where we agree and we know where we disagree. And Barnier came out and essentially said that we're at a massive impasse because of this thing on citizens' rights, whereby the citizens' rights going forward are going to have to be overseen by a supranational court of some kind. Usually that would be the ECJ, as it currently is. And of course, one of the Tories' red lines is that we can no longer be subject to the jurisdiction of the ECJ in any way. And so Barnier, I think, essentially said, well, what's your solution to this? And we didn't have one. And so, yeah, it seemed like they basically came to an impasse and there was no kind of productive outcome from the talks whatsoever. But then following that, I think just maybe the next day, everything seemed to shift. And we spoke last week about, again, how, you know, Davis, Fox in particular, Boris has gone a bit quiet on the Brexit side of things, but Boris too, they seem to be putting on a good show, but not necessarily addressing what everyone else is saying. But it kind of seemed to change last week. We were talking particularly about the things that Davis was saying in front of the select committees, how they're sticking to this kind of very rigid party line, very rigid set of objectives, and we feel like they need to perhaps readjust their approach and their expectations. And it kind of felt like they all started to do it all at once last week. I mean, we had in one week, we had Liam Fox saying, you know, that it was going to be the easiest free trade agreement ever done. And then just a few days later on TV saying that he no longer thinks that it could be done in 2 years, which is something that they've all been saying for a very long time.
So hang on, my question then, before we go into the actual change of tone, is what has made them shift their tone?
We were talking about this earlier on. We're not really sure. It kind of seemed to happen very suddenly, and we're thinking that it's maybe linked to the proceedings of the second round of negotiations, but we don't really know, because it did seem to happen overnight that they all kind of shifted slightly and stopped sticking to these kind of rigid lines that they've been using for so long.
I mean, it does seem odd, doesn't it, that it all changed? Because there's not really many people with more clout than the people that we've been listening to. So to think it's come up from high or something would be, well, it just doesn't seem logical.
No, it doesn't. And part of me wonders if this has come from the Brussels side of the negotiations, I must admit. I've no evidence for this whatsoever. I think, Alex, we talked last week about the sudden rise of EFTA. So all of a sudden, mm-hmm. the EFTA phrase, European Free Trade Association, all of a sudden it was being pushed from Brussels side.
Yes.
I mean, almost like it was they were just dangling a carrot. You know, in every sort of statement there was, there is EFTA, you know, you might like to think about it. And it's almost like, I don't understand what's going on in our ministers' heads, but I'm delighted that it is. And it appears to indicate that they might be being open to a bit more pragmatic view of all this than we thought just a week ago.
A number of signs, I think. And I think the first one was that we spoke last week about the disagreements between Philip Hammond and that he was very interested in there being an implementation phase or a transition phase, whatever phrase you want to use. Well, first of all, there was an article in the Huffington Post where Gove and Davis had agreed that there would now need to be a transition period until 2022. They stipulated that they see freedom of movement of people continuing until at least 2022, which to me reads that they're accepting that single market membership will continue until 2022, because why would you accept to continue freedom of movement if you don't want the rest of it? So that reads to me like they're interested now in a transition period where we stay inside the single market for the foreseeable future. And then following the second round of negotiations and this whole impasse that they came to over ECJ jurisdiction, somebody actually asked the question of Barnier. Someone asked him, you know, what other countries accept jurisdiction of foreign courts over their citizens? And he specifically said Norway and EFTA. You know, like, they're making it very, very obvious that they see this as a kind of compromise and as a solution. He went on to say, EEA countries have the same legal system. The EFTA court dovetails with the ECJ. And the most important thing for Brussels, is that the UK shows respect for EU case law. He said he reinforces that the EFTA court is a sensible compromise, at least for a transition period, as it's an independent body but is recognised by the EU. And then Barnier said all this after the negotiations broke down. It really seems like they're really kind of shoving this in our faces at this point.
And why? Why are they so keen for us to get this? Well, what I see is a pretty good deal, actually.
Basically,
is it a good deal?
Yeah, I think we here would agree that it's a good deal, because it makes everything just so easy compared to how it would be if you're trying to negotiate a bespoke FTA. Off the shelf option, basically.
It is. That's it. It's not about that. It makes it easy. I'm glad you said that. The easier is important here. Even going for. Even had we decided, you know, at the point of the referendum that the EEA EFTA route was what we were going to take, it's still a lot of work involved.
Yes.
But it's a minute amount of the work involved compared to renegotiating everything from scratch. It would allow, certainly it ticks the referendum question box, because you would be technically outside of the European Union. There's all sorts of questions, and, you know, there'll be some, even under this option, there'll be some pretty strong political leadership needed to assuage the Leave side that, A, this isn't a temporary hole into which we're going to get stuck forever. There'll be some delicate stuff to deal with the continued freedom of people. We know technically within the EEA treaty, one of the articles whose number I can't remember, theoretically allows a member state to restrict migration numbers. It's only ever been used in Liechtenstein, which is not surprisingly a pretty special edge case. Mm-hmm. Could you get away with that as a major economy and the second largest in EU? Maybe, maybe not, but there is a clause which can be worked with. That much we know. And then, of course, the single market membership, the continued access to the European market unhindered, the continued access to all of the free trade agreements mm-hmm. that the EU currently has with other third countries, all of that stays on the table. And, as you know, I'm sure Michael Gove will be delighted, well, of course, what you don't get as part of the EEA treaties is common agriculture policy, common fisheries policy, and there's one other aspect, actually, which I've now forgotten. Mm-hmm. So you do start to be able to repatriate some of those.
Right, so where's the downside? Where are hardcore Brexiteers going to lose their mind? Where?
I suspect it's the issue. For me, I suspect it'll be the freedom of people issue. Essentially, you know, continue for them. I suppose there's a bit of a nuance here. For the very noisy side of the Leave campaign, the freedom of people bit is a big issue. the post-referendum polling suggested it was a large but minority issue. And I think that's a really important point. And we've also seen actually some more recent polling over the past week or so that there's now a majority, if it was a trade-off between single market membership and restricted migration, a majority, or at least the largest share, would opt for single market membership rather than that. So there's been a bit of a subtle shift in public opinion anyway. Not huge, but there's been a subtle shift. But I suspect it would be handling that. Now, from my point of view, personal viewpoint, I don't see that as a problem, providing the political narrative is woven well and there's a good, strong sense of leadership in where we're going. If you sell this as, look, this is the easiest possible way to achieve the objectives you all want, you know, outside the EU, outside EEA, outside all of that, then actually I think it's perfectly possible to weave a sensible political narrative about this. My fear a week ago, which is, as I said, definitely less now, is actually, it feels like they're now starting to soften the ground for this. The challenge is, of course, is they're going to have to work harder to soften the ground, because they've actually spent the last 2 years hardening that ground as much as they can. So they're going to have to undo a lot of what they've already done, but I think it's doable.
I think the other side that might be difficult with this one is the whole kind of sovereignty issue, and the fact that as continuing members of the single market, we'd still be subjected to lots of the regulations and things like that.
Give me an example of that.
Well, I mean, essentially, we would still be subjected to all the exact same rules that we are now in terms of having our goods recognised and getting across borders and things like that.
Isn't that the same, even, say, if as a manufacturer in the United States trying to import into the EU? I mean,
not quite, no, because it's a single market and not a free trade area. So the free trade area is within that, so it goes one level above. So it's true, let's pick two third countries that we know are completely separate. Let's choose for random USA and, I don't know, Brazil.
Yeah.
So any goods made in the USA for export to Brazil will have to meet Brazilian regulations. That's nice and straightforward, no problem there. If there were a single market between the USA and Brazil, that would mean all goods made in the USA, all goods, regardless of their destination, have to meet Brazil's requirements. Mm. So that's essentially what the single market bit does. So even if I'm making goods in the UK, here in Manchester, and I'm going to sell them to a client in Leeds, I have to hit EU regs for those, even though I'm not necessarily selling into the EU. That's the different bit. So the single market will continue to evolve, as it does all the time. And those decisions made at the ECJ about components of the single market would be enforced down to EEA members. Though there are exceptions and there are edge cases. So Norway, on the whole, will be required to implement, well, theoretically to implement pretty much all ECJ legislation, all EU legislation regarding the single market. But actually it can veto stuff and not implement it. But what it will have to do is pay the cost of doing so. So there may be an additional charge to Norway for not implementing that legislation. There may be crackdowns in other aspects of its trading relationship. But it does have the power to veto, although it can't do it cost-free.
Because there's still this idea that Brexit's going to lead to a massive wave of deregulation. And I think some people are scared that if we get ourselves into the EEA, then that'll remove the possibility of that happening. Because we will always have to be in line with the EU rules. But I would argue that we would always want to be in line with those rules anyway. And what the EEA does, which is different to, for example, a free trade agreement or an MRA, which is a mutual recognition agreement, those things are negotiated at a set period in time. And then as the kind of regulations and rules change, they have to be renegotiated and updated to make sure that you remain in line with the regulations. Whereas the EEA kind of automatically adopts new EU legislation. So the EEA representatives will take the new regulations and then write them into EEA law. So it's kind of like this automatic process for keeping us in line with the EU rules and regulations.
Yeah, I think it's a case of the sensible regulations. So, I mean, we all want our aircraft to be built to a fairly high standard, but on the other hand, we don't want to have to put may contain salmon on a pack of smoked salmon.
Yeah.
I mean, I think those are the sort of things where we hope to repatriate, you know.
The question comes down to the fact that the EU is our biggest trading partner, and obviously we could change regulations and things like that for ourselves if we remove ourselves from the EEA or the single market. But would we really want to do so when the EU is still our biggest trading partner? Because we would still have to comply with the EU's rules when trading with the EU.
Yeah.
We just wouldn't have to comply with them when we're consuming those products here or selling them elsewhere. And then how much room do you think there is for companies to start producing one set of goods for sale in one destination? And one...
That's it. And that doesn't happen. Yeah. We talk to all our big manufacturers. No manufacturer, even the global manufacturers, do not run an EU supplied, an EU manufacturing process and a non-EU manufacturing process.
Is that right?
No, because it's too expensive. But, you make, I mean, you manufacture
all,
to the
big
best
differences,
standards.
Aren't there, between, say, cars which are for the EU market and cars which are for the US market?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be an example of two different streams where a manufacturer is actually building two sets of products.
But I think what they do is they make sure that they comply to both, basically.
That's it.
Ah, yeah. Right, so the standard is...
Highest regulation taking
up to that level is basically done globally, which I think goes back to one of the arguments why potentially the EU's going to become outdated over the next maybe few decades.
Exactly, because you talk about like food labelling. Actually, most food labelling regs is coming down from the UNECE.
Yeah.
It's not coming from the EU. You know, there are global standards at play here.
Can I just rewind something? I found something Alex just said really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The EU might become outdated. Just explain that process, because I think that's really interesting.
This is kind of like a leave argument that was made before the referendum, and I think there's something to it, and it's essentially that we're moving towards a position where all these rules and regulations will be agreed on a global scale rather than you know, so the EU is a kind of a trade bloc and does its own things and pushes the regulatory agenda, you know, in a way which has been productive and successful over its history. But increasingly, those decisions and those regulations are coming from global bodies like the WTO or, for food standards, something like Codex Alimentarius. And these are these kind of unilateral bodies that will eventually kind of set global rules so that everyone will have to comply to the same standards. So the argument is that while the EU might have made loads and loads of progress in making sure that all these countries can trade easily by making sure they all comply with each other, eventually that's going to happen on a global scale rather than just on an EU scale, which is one of the arguments why people would say, for example, that the Norway option would actually be okay in terms of losing our EU influence, because we could then take seats on global bodies and exert more influence in these global bodies where potentially in the future these decisions are going to be being made.
I see. That's a really interesting point of view. Okay. So shall we move this conversation on, unless you've got anything else to add to that?
No, I think the only thing probably I would add on that is we're talking there about kind of mutual recognition agreements and auto, you know, the way the EU relationship works is stuff gets automatically transposed over. And it's for reasons like that Liam Fox, or we would have said last week, Liam Fox is wrong to say this will be the easiest trade deal in history.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, like everything in bits of complex policy, he's kind of right and kind of wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He's right in the sense that, of course, the battle in doing most big free trade agreements is getting the regulatory systems closely aligned, if not identically aligned in certain places. That's usually a huge upheaval for one of the partners, usually the smaller. Not surprisingly, because the bigger you are, the more influence you exert in all of that. That, of course, is not an issue as we leave the EU, because our regulatory systems are identical. The EU regulatory system is the UK regulatory system. That's easy. The challenge is, what does it look like in the future? Now, what makes an FTA with the EU potentially quite complex is actually our line over ECJ jurisdiction.
Mm.
Because what makes it complex is that will only work providing we can agree to keep our regulatory systems in check. So what we have today can exist in the future, providing our regulatory system evolves to at least the same standard. You can go further, of course, that's fine. At least the same standard as the EU. So what most free trade agreements, what these MRAs do, Alex talked about, mutual recognition agreements, and how they have to keep evolving, is they keep have to evolving because regulation changes. The EU works in this respect because regulation automatically updates.
Yeah. So let's just go off on a tangent a second. So an agreement such as, is it TTP or
TTIP?
TTIP, which is the one which got thrown out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, now I imagine the stumbling block there, and we can kind of round this on to another subject which has been topical in the news, would be the standardisation of regulation between the USA and the EU.
Yeah.
I imagine that's why And
it's a huge one. It's a huge one in any FTA, but from a Western kind of European perspective, so from the EU's perspective, countries like Australia, New Zealand, even South Africa to some extent, their regulatory systems are all kind of similar. Very different levels, but they're all kind of similar. The USA is a complete outlier in the sense the way the regulatory system is devised is just completely different. So from an EU perspective, one of the big, and often, you know, people have often said this is one of the huge hurdles in releasing new products, new chemicals, new food processing techniques into the EU market, is what you must do is conclusively prove that it is safe.
Yeah, so there's two ways to do this, isn't there? There's prove it's not harmful and prove it's completely safe, or something, which sounds the same, but it's actually very different.
That's a decent enough division. And the US one is, it doesn't appear to be harmful.
Track on.
Yep. The EU model, and as I said, a lot of the Western world, is you must conclusively prove there is nothing damaging here. Now, that gives you two totally different standards, and that is why TTIP, that's why actually against, you know, the stuff that I guess is going to come up next, becomes really hard when you're looking for a deal between the EU, or particularly the UK in this instance, and the US.
If you've got the two biggest markets, US. Do you count the EU as a single as a market, or is it China?
Yeah, you can't both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I'm trying to get at is it US and then EU? Is it US then China then EU?
It depends in terms of what you're talking about.
Yeah, depends how you count it, really. So if you're counting it in GDP, then it's America, China, EU. If you're counting it in population, then it's certainly China, EU, US. If you talk it in terms of trade volumes, it flips differently. I think regulatory influence.
Right. Yeah, EU probably.
EU will trump absolutely in terms of global regulatory influence.
So you've got America at the moment. So this is a great example of how it could be problematic, who apparently are getting rid of 16 regulations for every new regulation that they're bringing in currently.
Gosh.
Think about that.
I never like the regulation count things because it's terribly easy to get rid of ones that don't affect anybody and replace them with ones that do, which is what we saw here. The coalition government had a lovely system called the Red Tape Challenge.
That was two for one, was it not?
It started off at 1 for 1 and 2 for 1, and you make the multiplier up as you like. But what you say is, well, I can introduce this new regulation which will, you know, impose a cost of £5 per employee per year forever, but I'll take away these two. I'll take away the selling of fireworks to underage people, and I'll take away the, you know, what wood beds can be made
of cows.
Exactly. So yeah, counts are no good. We got to look at cost. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, one of the regulatory, how can I call it? One of the regulations that has made the news recently is Liam Fox's adventures with the US and coming back with chlorinated chicken or something, some such thing. How has this made the news? Is it important?
This is kind of representative of what we've just been talking about. So in America, apparently, if you've been to America and you've eaten chicken in America, you have eaten chlorinated chicken, because that's what everybody eats in America. And it's chicken that has essentially been dipped into some chlorine water to clean it of bacteria. And so the issue is that the EU doesn't allow this chicken to be sold within the EU market because we hold ourselves to higher standards.
Do we have to dip it in chlorine twice?
But this is a nice example, you see. Chlorinated chicken has not been proven to be harmful.
Yeah.
But it's not been proven to not be harmful.
Yes.
And that's your regulatory challenge. Yeah. So the EU bans it.
Yeah, so this is representative of potentially one of the difficulties with us doing a trade deal with America, because they will want us to accept chlorinated chicken into Britain post-Brexit, whereas at the minute we don't, and there's lots of people who are grossed out by the idea of chlorinated chicken. I would just point out that according to my research, chlorinated chicken is totally fine, and it's completely safe, and apparently drinking a glass of water will expose you to as much chlorine as a chlorinated chicken will. But I
love the fact that you've done the research on it.
I can understand why people are grossed out. Apparently, you'd have to eat 3 whole chickens in a day to reach the EU's kind of minimum level of...
Sounds like a challenge.
Yeah, challenge.
Minimum level of risk or something like that.
But it's a great example, I think, though, it's of a practical one about where you've got to be careful and why international trade deals are hard. So it's perfectly possible that we could walk away from the EU and do a deal which allows clonated chicken to come into the UK. And people say, well, that's cool, that's coming to the UK, it doesn't affect the EU. But all of a sudden, what that will do is the risk mitigation for chicken imports from the UK to the EU will go up. So at the moment, you know, mutual recognition, there would almost certainly, you would never get, even though we could say, the UK government could say, we will import some American chicken for consumption in the UK, we will sell some chicken from the UK, which is non-chlorinated, to the EU. The chance of a mutual recognition agreement coming about, which says we don't, which says the EU thinks we don't need to check the chicken coming into the EU, is really low. So this is about inspection of goods and do they meet standards. At the moment, as part of the single market, all of our enforcement bodies are approved by the EU to say, if the UK's checked it, we're happy. We don't need to do anything else. And mostly that's done on a risk basis. So how likely do we think violations of code might be? If we're importing loads of chlorinated chicken from the US for consumption here, which might be being processed by the same factories, same warehouses, same supermarket refrigeration units, you can almost guarantee that the chance of getting any free trade deal between the UK and the EU, which included chicken or processed chicken, is now much lower because you're exposing risks. Or you might get it, but there'll be greater checks, greater quantities of chickens being stopped at borders, etc. And so this is a sliver of an issue.
But it's very representative of lots of bigger issues.
It is. Now multiply this by a million product types.
Because there are other impacts. So I believe chlorinated chicken would come out, like imported chlorinated chicken to Britain would come out at just under 80% of the cost of chickens we currently grow and buy here. So potentially we would have access to cheaper chickens because we've been importing loads of them from America. But currently, I believe British farmers, there's something in the EU where that restricts kind of movement of poultry. And I think there's an argument that in France, they're much, much more efficient at rearing chickens than we are. And that potentially some of our agriculture sector is...
That's got to be an animal welfare standard thing.
Agricultural sector is kind of being protected somewhat from competition from elsewhere. Because of the current regulations within the EU. So then the argument is that if we expose ourselves to chlorinated chicken, all of our chicken farmers will go under because they have to produce things. The way that they're set up currently is to produce things to a higher standard, which once we're exposed to cheaper chlorinated chicken, everyone might jump on board with that. And it'll give our farmers a big problem. My response to that as a free marketeer, by the way, would be if everyone is so grossed out by chlorinated chicken, why do you need to ban it? Because people just won't buy it. But I understand it's much more complicated than that.
I guess the problem isn't your Tesco finest, other supermarkets are available, luxury chicken breast. It's the things which chicken is in, which isn't so obvious.
Yeah, yeah. It's the minimum standard stuff, essentially. But as I said, it's a great example of what goes into the free trade deal. Because all of a sudden you expose the UK market to cheaper competition from third country for the US. That has implication on our domestic market and what we can do. But that will in turn have an impact on all free trade agreements that the UK signs with any other country. Because all of this stuff interacts. So if it looks like we might be shaving a few percentage points off the margin of UK farmers, who will then be looking for that margin to come back from somewhere else, which might affect France in a UK-EU trade deal, but that means that has an impact on France, so France will be looking. And it's all of this multi-part playoff against country. There's a reason trade deals usually take a decade.
And you can see why this stuff always ends up going global too, because what happens if China starts to want to do FTAs with people and China produces chlorinated chicken?
Yeah. Well, it's all going to be null and void soon anyway when they start growing it in labs. So we'll just wait for that.
But it's a great a tiny thing that's a great example of actually why this stuff is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And not for any of the reasons that you've actually heard on Twitter or the press.
No, exactly. No, it's not about tariffs and all the rest of it. But you'd probably look to do the tariffy thing, in that kind of situation. Oh, America can produce a chicken 20% cheaper than the UK. Okay, so let's stick a tariff on the imports of American chicken, at which point you're closing down a market for US exporters to the UK. So they'll say, okay, we want something in return.
Cashmere will be charged or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, well, last week we did say we were a little bit negative and we were going to do a show on how we would structure Brexit or should I say the ambitions of Brexit. So should we touch on that now for 5 minutes?
Why not? We can do Brexit in 5 minutes.
We can give it a go.
So the basic premise of this question is, last week we were talking about Brexit being the reason for Brexit, which is basically just leaving leaving the EU. There's no real substance behind it. So you two were going to kind of construct a way that... Have I got this right? Construct a way that you would leave the EU?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've broadly given all our cards away on that one. I think we both agree that the way we would do it is through the EEA and EFTA, and take this kind of step-by-step approach. There was a nice tweet that I saw that was the single market is a regulatory construct and the EU is a political construct, and to be a free trading nation, we need one but not necessarily the other.
That's a remarkably pithy summary, actually.
So I think you break it down into that into that kind of thing. So I think from the Tories' point of view, one of the mistakes that they've made is that they see Brexit as being the thing which is going to bring us all these new opportunities and things, where really it isn't. Brexit, it should just be an administrative task of getting us outside the EU. And then once that's done, then we can figure out what else we want to do.
I think that's exactly it. And I think if we cast our minds back all of these weeks ago to, I think, podcast number one, you know, one of the phrases we've used for a long time now is Brexit's a process, not an event. Mm-hmm. And so actually you said, what is it you want to do? What is it that the country wants to be able to do in this brave new world outside? And there are a few laudable ambitions. We want to be able to push free trade along. We want to be able to do free trade with third nations. It's almost certainly clear, I think it's reasonable to say, whilst we almost certainly would not get as good a trade deal, the UK on its own talking to a third country, as the EU would, simply because of sheer force of numbers and political clout, we could get something quicker away, something smaller away more quickly. Because one of the big barriers, of course, of the EU is essentially you've got to get 28 people to agree, and that's not easy, 29 once you put the third country in. So, of course, that's hard. So I think we can probably evolve in some of that stuff more quickly and say, let's tick a box for now that says, yes, we want to be able to do our own trade deals. There's clearly a desire amongst at least a large minority, if not a majority of the UK population, to restrict, even if not to restrict migration, then to at least flip a model from freedom of movement to some form of checking system, whatever that might be, points, whatever, you know, design a system that you like. Coming out of the EU will let you do that. Potentially staying in the EEA will let you do aspects of that. There's all of those bits. But again, as Alex came back to, it's the how do you get there? Mm. You know, the first stage to being able to do all this stuff is to get from the relationship we are in now to one which is outside the EU, but is basically identical to the one we are in now.
Yeah,
we've always said it's this step. It's the going from the day before Brexit to the day after Brexit without causing problems, that's the hard and the important bit. Because leaving the EU isn't hard. We could literally repeal the 1972 ECA and it is done. That will get us outside of the EU with one parliamentary vote. It will cause complete and utter carnage because all treaties cease to apply, all FTAs cease to agree, all agreements, everything just stops. So getting out's not hard. Getting out intact is pretty tricky and needs some work, but can be done. And the easiest way to get from in to out is via something like the EA. There's still loads to do. We're still going to have to write an agriculture policy from scratch. We're going to have to write a fisheries policy. We're going to have to write our own customs code, etc., etc. Those are hard enough, but it's much, much smaller than rewriting the entire thing.
So we see the EEA after Norway option as being an off-the-shelf option, but I've still read in some places that people expect it'll take 5 years more just to get us into that position. Because the EEA is a treaty system that has country-specific annexes and is tailored to each country. And so I think that the longer-term picture is that we get ourselves into the EEA, and I think some people would argue that we take that as a first stepping stone and then we look to get ourselves outside of that in the future. I'm not sure that would be the case, and obviously we'd have to reassess once we were there because of this whole issue of I think that it's in our best interest to remain compliant with the single market. I don't see any reason why we would want to lose that aspect. But there's definitely room for us to kind of reform the EEA or reverse engineer it in some way to better suit our needs once we're there. And so I wouldn't make any kind of statements about where I'd want us to go once we're in that position, but I think... we need to get ourselves there and then kind of take stock and see what we want to do.
Yeah, because then from that point your options become really wide and really large. Yeah. Alex is right, absolutely on EU regs. There is no way, you know, broadly it's not unreasonable to suggest over the next 10, 20, 30 years a whole host of other countries are going to come in broadly into line with EU regulation. It's the dominant regulator, albeit there's lots coming down from global level as well. It's seen as the gold standard. It's broadly half of our trade. It's broadly going to remain something like half our trade for a long time. Why? Because it's next door, and distance matters in international trade.
Just a quick challenge.
Why would we
kind
of separate away?
Just a quick challenge on that. You mentioned there's a free marketeer earlier. You know that you're fine for chlorinated chickens to come in, which yeah, I can see that. Why then would you keep all the regulations? Because surely if these regulations mattered to the consumer, they would just buy the things which were made to EU regs, but they'd have a choice of other products too.
That's a bit hard to entangle.
That's okay. Now, I would say, because it's about that stuff we talked about earlier, it's about future recognition. So the point is, every time the UK... were to potentially lower its standards or do trade deals with third countries, which implicitly...
That's a political thing, though, isn't it?
No, I think it is. That will have an impact on our relationship with the EU.
Because of
trusting what's going in. Because the whole thing about... I mean, let's go one step back. Free trade agreements and tariffs and all that kind of stuff only exist for the sake of protectionism.
Yeah,
that's the only reason they're there, and FTAs and mutual recognition agreements are trying to erode the kind of default protectionism that most countries start from and evolve away. So what, from the EU's point of view, they're going through all the conversations with us now. The one thing they will be maximising, the one thing they will want to get out of whatever the deal is that the UK cannot be used as a backdoor to the EU single market. That's the great. So if you create, and this is why things like the Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland border is going to be so hard.
Yes.
Because what it potentially allows you to do is have goods made within the UK, potentially to non-EU standards. If that's an open border, then those goods get straight into, because once they're inside the Republic of Ireland, they have free passage throughout the whole of Europe. It's the big issue about the migrant crisis in Europe. Is the huge problem is what you have to do when you create a closed system or a semi-closed system, be it the customs union or the freedom of movement in the Schengen area, all your reliance now is on your external border because there is nothing in the middle to stop. Once a person or a good is in the system, that's it. There is no opportunity to check anymore. So this is what the EU is going to be wavering. Now, the more our regulations shift from the EU... the greater the risk of the UK being used as a backdoor is, therefore the greater the propensity the EU will want to conduct checks. Maybe not on everything, maybe just randomised, but the more likely they are. If we're absolutely bang up to date and we enforce them and they trust our regulatory bodies to enforce those rules, then all of that goes away.
So I'll chip in just on your question now that I've thought about it, because it goes both ways, isn't it? Because the argument works for producers as well. So assume we regain kind of regulatory independence so that you can produce to the EU standards if you want, or you can produce to some kind of new domestic standards which we come up with.
Or no standards.
Why would you not produce to the EU standards when that is our biggest export market?
It's not... Well,
I can understand that. I mean, you're going to be coming down to, I mean, some of the examples which have been in the news, like we could produce, you know, Hoovers, which are 1,000 cc's more powerful or something like that. But why would Britain...
I guess my worry would be is regulation and the upping of standards for the sake of the upping of standards. I mean, I'm trying to think of an example now. Dog walking. Dog walking is an absolutely great one. All I want is my dog walker to show up and walk my dog. But recently she's shown up and she's now got first aid forms which I've got to fill in because she's now got to be insured. And would you believe it, the council has regulated the amount of dogs which you can take on a walk at any one time.
Ah, lovely. So it's nothing to do with the EU, it's your local council.
Yes, no. But the point about the regulation remains, whether it be council, whether it be EU, my worry would just be over-regulation for the sake of doing it and closing these things.
No, and you're right. And the EU does not have a good long-term history in regulating to minimum possible standards to keep things going. It does have a reputation for being onerous. Mm. It has, to be fair to it, over the last kind of 5 or 10 years, started to introduce quite a lot of reviews of all of that, where it's trying to, you know, remove stuff that isn't necessary. But essentially, your big thing is international competitiveness.
Yeah.
So that's the, you know, mm-hmm. that should be the driver. If you can buy product A from an EU to EU standards, which is, you know, £100 and really good, or you can buy one for £60 and isn't really good, then actually you have a competitiveness issue.
I guess my point is...
that should kind of pass through.
If the regulations were really worth their while, you wouldn't need to protect your market because the consumers would value them anyway.
Well, I think that puts an awful lot of onus onto consumers to understand what's out in the market. And, you know, actually the reason regulatory environments have evolved over the past 200 years is precisely because we understand that the availability of pure information to the market as a whole is pretty limited. It's also important when you're buying across borders. So one of the big examples is food regulation. Why do my bananas have to be, you know, a certain curvature and a certain diameter and all that kind of stuff? Because if I go to Sainsbury's, I can look at them and decide which ones I want. Cool. But you need to make sure that that Sainsbury's buying agent in London, when it buys bananas from the Canary Islands, knows what they are buying. That's why we have them. So I know that I'm buying these bananas at £2 a kilo because they meet these thresholds. And you can buy standards less if you like, but actually what you tend to find is as regulations come in, everything rises to the highest. Because on the whole, it's not worth producing more than one stream. So regulations are, you know, they're to help all of these actually, you know, big hidden macroeconomic effects, which actually, to be fair, don't get discussed in public much because they're pretty technical and they're often bedded down in hundreds of years of research as to why they're there. So yes, your regs are, when I buy something that isn't in front of me, or even a complex item that is in front of me, I'm going to buy this computer. How do I know what's inside it? How do I know to what standard it is? How do I verify that? Well, actually, the CE mark on the bottom says it is there to European.
So you can take this one step further as well. So I said earlier, if we regain regulatory independence, so companies here would then probably have to comply with EU regs anyway if they want to sell to that market. But if we were doing it through something like an FTA or an MRA, our regulations and rules and the EU's regulations and rules would diverge then over time. So we'd have a different framework to them. So our companies would then be obliged to continue complying to their regulations. But then because they would have a system in place to make sure that those goods comply with those regulations, we on this side would then have to set up our own systems to make sure that their goods complied with their own ones. Mm-hmm. And then the EU companies would then have to start complying to our regulatory framework rather than ours. And why would they do that just to sell to the UK when they can just sell to the rest of the EU?
Yeah.
So those size of markets things is really important. I think, and this is where I remember getting a lot of kickback from leavers, particularly hard leavers, as it were, in the early days, when I said, look, you know, the EU holds the upper hand in all this. It's, oh, yeah, but, you know, the trade balance and all that. It's just a sheer matter of fact that there are 440 million people on the mainland EU and 60 here, that the EU is the world's largest trade bloc. It is well respected as a regulator. When I talk about upper hand, yeah, it has political upper hand just because it's larger. Fine, it's 27 countries. It's also, it's club. The EU is the EU's club, so it has a political upper hand from that. But it just has a practical upper hand because its market is larger. It's the one that's been doing this. It's well established as a global regulator. It has very good, you know, it's regarded well amongst all the global bodies in terms of implementation and management. It's broadly recognised as being a pragmatic regulator. It doesn't go lifting standards insanely above where they need to be. It does do that in some areas, certainly. But on the whole, you know, all of those things give it the upper hand in this.
It's incredibly complex thing because you can make... You can make counter arguments for pretty much everything, but you can also appreciate the advantages that this, you know, that this necessitates.
Yeah. So my line has always been: it's never about that we're going to get hammered or we can't come up with a good deal, but there has to be a recognition that, actually, as Alex has said, why would we diverge from the body that's kind of leading global standards development and is next door and is our largest trading partner? Mm-hmm. Just from a sheer practical, once you start to talk about the trade agreements and the mutual recognition agreements and all of that, the answer simply becomes, well, actually, why would you bother? Mm. It's just not in anybody's interest. The idea that we can suddenly deregulate is just not plausible. Well, it's a lovely idea, but it's just not plausible.
We've only spoken about trade as well today, and obviously there's hundreds of other areas where we're going to have to figure these things out.
Yeah,
and
so, drug regulation, standards of cars, car safety equipment, all of that.
If we want to negotiate individual deals, individual static agreements on all these various areas, then essentially we find ourselves in Switzerland's position, and Switzerland isn't happy with their position, and the EU's not happy with Switzerland's position, because Switzerland have to constantly negotiate with the EU and have to give up things like ECJ jurisdiction, like the things precisely which we want to get rid of. Switzerland have to take in order to maintain convergence with the single market. So doing this through a whole bunch of different agreements is potentially a path for us ending up in the worst possible position.
Absolutely, and certainly if you try to do it quickly, I can imagine scenarios where that happens over a very long time. That, you know, we get to EEA standards, we get to the EEA position, we're starting to do deals with anyone else. Actually, the nature of how supply chains are currently structured might change over decades, which then perhaps opens up an opportunity where the UK says, actually, we're no longer really nested within all of this in Europe, in this bit of a sector. Here are some opportunities we might now push with emerging markets because we think we've got it. And I think that's the last bit, I'll sort of close on that, is, you know, all of this dominance and why you would follow the EU regs is all because people say, well, other countries are not in the EU and they manage okay. It's fine, but other countries have not been in the EU where business, individuals, consumers have slowly integrated because they could. Mm. Yeah? We joined the EU, but that didn't mean that companies had to structure themselves to trade in the way they have. But the point is, they have. So all of those supply chains are now set up because of the relationship we currently have. So changing that relationship quickly can be really hard because actually, if we were in a different world, the business and consumer world wouldn't look like what it looks like now. But it does. So it's the thing about we are where we are. I said you could see, we separate, we become EEA members. I don't know, maybe, I'm not predicting this, this is just an example. Maybe our relationship and supply chains in auto manufacturing changes, and actually we cease to be a major player in the European market. Can't see it happening, but just as a sheer kind of example, that it fades away, our relationship from the UK and the EU in that sector fades away enough over 20, 30 years that you think, actually, I'm now happy to sever all the MRAs and everything between us and them in this sector, because actually we see an opportunity to go and work to do full-blown open markets access with Korea and the Philippines because we think they're doing some really cute stuff on autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
And we want to be part of that. And actually, for us, we think that's a better market in the future than that one. That's cool, but all those things are going to happen over decades, not
years.
It's
not going to be quick.
Yeah.
Well, one last question for the day then. We've had chlorinated chicken. I want you both to give me an example of a ridiculous thing which is going to enter the public conversation over the next 6 months. There's got to be something.
There's hundreds, I suspect, and that's going to be the boom bit. I mean, I quite like the way things like Open Skies has got people going now, because what's lovely is nobody had heard of it. Mm. The idea got introduced into the public consciousness with kind of Ryanair talking about it. Basically, everybody is now commenting on it, despite the fact that nobody has read the agreement or understands what it is. So there's an interview on Radio 4 either this morning or yesterday, which immediately said, of course, the problems are X, Y, and Z. And you think, no, they're not. No, you've misunderstood actually what this does. And I think that's what we're going to see lots of.
Do you know what? I've got a funny feeling we're going to see some sort of regulation. Do you like the way France only regulates how many French songs has to be on French radio? Well, I think once the main English language country leaves, there's going to be some sort of regulation on how many English language songs are going to be in the EU. I've just got a funny feeling that's going to go wrong.
I'll give you one. I think it's been in the news before, but I think it'll come up at some point. I think football is going to be used as an example for something. I think the movement of players, movement of funds between clubs, you know, involvement in different leagues. I think that'll be representative
European
of some issues.
Competition, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good one.
That'll come up at some point.
That's it, because European competition is nothing to do with the EU, but the free movement of people and free movement of capital rules particularly help and support all that to happen. That would be much harder to do UK US. You'd very, very hard to see that kind of movement of players. Mm-hmm. The volume. Again, it happens, odd ones. But actually, by the time there are levies against that, we've seen China recently has put 100% tariff on international football players coming into China. So, you know, this stuff.
Have they?
Yeah. So this stuff does happen. And people kind of think, oh, well, that's nothing to do with this thing, nothing to do with trade. You're right, it's not. But the point is the EU agreement is much, much broader than just trade.
Excellent. Right. Well, thank you as always for listening. Thank you for following us on Twitter and leaving us those iTunes reviews. Just before we go, anything happening in the Chamber of Commerce this week?
Oh, there's lots happening. We've just got a new membership offer, actually, that we've launched with some new helplines and 24-hour helplines for companies on tax and VAT and HR and horrifyingly forgotten the last one. But go and take our website, dmchamber.co.uk/chamberprotect. Great new set of services that you can get from that.
And just a quick message to our listener, Graham Pollard, who is a little bit upset about our levels. I guarantee I will try and sort them out this episode. We don't want to lose you as a subscriber. So until next week, we will see you then. Goodbye.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.